Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All Compassionate, the All Merciful. Salam and welcome to our latest episode of Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, that was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. As you know, after completing explanation of Surah Munafiqun, we have taken explanation of the next surah, that is Surah Taqabun, which is number 64 in the serial order of compilation of the Noble Quran. Revealed in Medina, it has 18 ayahs and takes its name from the word Yawmut Taqabun in ayah 9, which means the day of mutual loss and gain, and refers to the day of resurrection and judgment as the day of dispossession, since on that day, everyone will try to save oneself and put the blame on others. For those who abandon faith and choose to disbelieve, they shall lose paradise and be thrown into hellfire, cheated forever from felicity by their own souls and their leaders. Those who believe shall gain paradise against all the attempts of the unbelievers to distract them in the world from faith and goodness, because of their guidance by God and His messengers to steer away from hellfire. The surah opens with a description of God's majesty, power, wisdom, and knowledge. It reminds the disbelievers of the miserable end of those who disbelieved before them and decisively refutes their denial of the resurrection. The surah urges the believers to be wary but forgiving of the enemies they may have within their own families, and inspires them to remain steadfast and to spend in God's cause. We have already explained ayahs 1 to 6 of this surah in our last episode, and today we present you explanation of ayahs 7 to 12. So let us start with ayahs 7 and 8.
زعم الذين كفروا أن لن يبعثوا قل بلى وربي لتبعثن ثم لتنبؤن بما عملتم وذلك على الله يسير فآمنوا بالله ورسوله والنور الذي أنزلنا وَاللَّهُ بِمَا تَعْمَلُونَ خَبِيرٌ.
The faithless claim that they will not be resurrected. Say, yes, By my Lord, you will surely be resurrected. Then you will be informed of what you did, and that is easy for Allah. So have faith in Allah and His Prophet and the light which we have sent down. And Allah is well aware of what you do. If you might recall, in the previous episode of this program, last month, we said the Almighty Creator has power over all and everything and has granted human beings the freedom to differentiate between right and wrong, which means the consequences of their words and actions rest upon them. We also said that the creation of the universe is not haphazard and unplanned, but rather in accordance with specific aim. This means the Almighty Creator is aware of our secret deeds and hidden intentions and motives, and it is only the proper cognizance of God that inspires us to do good deeds and prevents us from committing sins. The ayahs that we recited to you now mean to say that the faithless deny the resurrection and are thus totally unprepared for the final judgment. God commands the prophet to inform them of the certainty of the day of resurrection on which all the people will be raised to life to see the report card of their deeds, on the basis of which they will either be rewarded or punished. As Ayah 8 informs us, we should have firm faith in our loving Creator and obey whatever has been commanded by the Prophet, who is accompanied by the celestial light for our clear guidance. These ayahs teach us that, number one, it is lack of faith which makes people deny eventuality of the day of resurrection and thus bring eternal damnation upon themselves. Number two, every minute deed of ours is recorded by the angels for presentation on the day of resurrection to determine reward or punishment. Number three, it is all within the infinite power of the Almighty Creator to raise the dead back to life, even if they had become rotten bones and dust. And number four, the ayahs of the Quran are light to enable us to come out of darkness and proceed towards the ultimate truth. Now let us listen to ayahs 9 and 10 of Surah Taghabun.
يَوْمَ يَجْمَعُكُمْ لِيَوْمِ الْجَمْعِ ذَلِكَ يَوْمُ التَّغَابُنِ وَمَنْ يُؤْمِنْ بِاللَّهِ وَيَعْمَلْ صَالِحًا يُكَفِّرْ عَنْهُ سَيِّئَاتِهِ وَيُدْخِلْهُ جَنَّاتٍ تَجْرِي مِنْ تَحْتِهَا الْأَنْهَارُ خَالِدِينَ فِيهَا أَبَدًا ذَلِكَ الْفَوْزُ الْعَظِيمُ والذين كفروا وكذبوا بآياتنا أولئك أصحاب النار خالدين فيها وبئس المصير.
The day when he will gather you for the day of gathering, that will be a day of disposition for the disbelievers. And whoever has faith in Allah and acts righteously shall be absolved of misdeeds and admitted into gardens with streams running in them to remain therein forever. That is the great success. But as for those who are faithless and deny our signs, they shall be the inmates of the fire to remain in it forever. And it is an evil destination. These ayahs refer to another feature of the Day of Resurrection, which is actually the name of this surah. It means taqabun, or dispossession of the disbelievers when they are raised to life and regret the loss they have incurred upon themselves because of their wicked ways during worldly life. The virtuous who are rewarded with gardens where streams of fresh water flow will also regret of not having done more good deeds while alive in order to achieve higher rewards when they see the unimaginable bounties of the hereafter. Ayah 10 warns the faithless of the punishment for their disbelief and death in the state of sins and agnosticism, saying that they will be cast into the fires of hell, which is indeed an evil destination. These ayahs teach us the following points. Number one, while alive, we should make the best of the opportunity which God has granted us by doing good deeds and abstaining from evil, so as to avoid the great regret of dispossession on the Day of Judgment. Number two, Allah, the Most Merciful, not only rewards the true believers for their virtuous deeds, but also absolves them of the misdeeds they might have committed and sought forgiveness. Number three, since the entry into paradise requires purity and cleansing from the filth of sins, in some cases, the erring believers might have to pass temporarily through hell. And number four, everyone is in pursuit of success and happiness, but true success and happiness will be gained only through faith in God and doing of righteous deeds. In conclusion of today's episode of Path Towards Enlightenment, here are ayahs 11 and 12 of Surah Taqabun.
ما أصاب من مصيبة إلا بإذن الله ومن يؤمن بالله يهد قلبه والله بكل شيء عليم وأطيعوا الله وأطيعوا الرسول فإن توليتم فإنما على رسولنا البلاغ المبين.
No affliction visits anyone except by Allah's leave. Whoever has faith in Allah, He guides his or her heart, and Allah has knowledge of all things. So, obey Allah and His Prophet. But if you turn away, then our Prophet's duty is only to communicate in clear terms. Disasters and problems are part of the worldly life of all human beings, whether believers or disbelievers. This means the faithful ought to be patient in the face of trials and tribulations, since nothing happens except by the will of God. And those with firm faith will surely be guided by the all-merciful Creator who has knowledge of all and everything. Among the signs of the true believers is their obedience to Almighty Allah through observance of whatever the Prophet has taught and preached. The duty of the prophets is only to convey the message of God to mankind and explain it through clear proofs, rather than forcing people to become Muslims. From these ayahs, we learn that, number one, faith in God helps us to be firm and steadfast in the face of hardships and calamities, rather than becoming impatient and losing hope in divine mercy. Number two, lofty concepts like patience, trust, satisfaction, and submission to God are factors that guide believers and make them overcome disasters. And number three, prophets have the duty of proclaiming Allah's message in clear terms. They do not impose faith on the people, since God has granted free will to the human race with warnings to discern good from evil, on the basis of which will be the final reward and punishment.
We say to America is be true to what you said on paper.
We won't back down.
Stop the witches!
Stand here now.
We will resist.
I can't breathe. Help me. Please.
We the people.
American policing is violent, humiliating, and dehumanizing. It has led to thousands of avoidable deaths. Since the 2020 murder of George Floyd, police killings have only continued at a rate of over 1,000 people per year. Black people, who account for 13% of the U.S. population, accounted for 27% of those fatally shot and killed by police. Cruel policing. There have also been high-profile cases from Keenan Anderson, who shouted, "They're trying to George Floyd me," to Tyree Nichols, who was brutally killed by police.
Relax.
Man, I can't breathe in my face. Just get up.
What do you want?
I can't breathe. Please, the knee in my neck. I can't breathe shit.
They're trying to kill me.
Why is this happening at such an alarming rate anyway?
Very frankly, this is nothing new that's going on in this country. America was built off the blood and the pain of my ancestors. America has always been killing black men. This did not just start this generation. This is just the first generation that's able to see it. Why it keeps going is because the people in power allow it to keep going. When you're dealing with racism, when you're dealing with discrimination in jobs, discrimination in housing, discrimination on the banks. You understand that you're in a society.
America, of course, was not the only slave-holding country in the West that committed horrible things against black people. While other Western countries seem to have distanced themselves from the shameful legacies of the history of slavery, America is lagging behind.
I think America, like many states that have the history of colonization, imperialism, and so forth, are yet to, and this is predominantly within the global west, in the global north, these countries have to confront that. And America is not unique in this particular context. I suppose if one is to look at America's uniqueness, it would be in the difficulty to confront that particular history in a fashion that is honest and truthful. If you look at countries like South Africa, when they looked at how best you reshape a society that has been divided by apartheid and so forth, they looked at a holistic societal approach. We can question the efficacy, but there's what we can look at within the context of the discourse we're having is that historically, if these issues are not discussed, like in South Africa, they had that discussion. The Truth Commission, right? Truth and Healing Commission, I think they called it at the time.
According to the Pew Research Survey, black adults are about five times as likely as whites to say they've been unfairly stopped by police because of their race or ethnicity. What are the root causes of this discrimination?
Every black American feels a little nervous when a police officer is arrives behind them, maybe even is approaching them. Because we've seen so much abuse, so much trauma. We all need therapy. We know that it only takes a look, just saying the wrong thing, and you might end up wrestling with the police. And I truly believe, this is what's causing some of the panicking that you see in these videos with black civilians. When you see someone, you know, trying to escape the police, it's not like always, I have something on me, or, you know, I'm a criminal and I want to run. No, sometimes it's just like, I don't want to die.
Black people have been historically subject to decades of segregation, disinvestment, redlining, and mass incarceration. This legacy still shows itself in the form of heavy and disproportionate surveillance and violence by police.
Black people, you know, my people, are captured and contained through generations, right? New mechanisms to further punish, to further destroy any element of dignity and history and language. And then after that, you know, introduce an abolishment movement of slavery and so forth, and put them into society with no instruments of survival, no education, no critical frameworks that enable human existence to at least demonstrate parity and enable people to be emboldened to do it for themselves. Nothing of the sort. They're simply left at their own whim. Right, and are expected to survive and historically perpetuate. We've seen a lot of great movements, you know, from the, as I pointed to, you know, the Civil Acts, you know, Civil Rights Act, signage in 1964. And I definitely see that as a step forward. But we've never seen any great policies that look at the holistic institutions from a fundamental basis as to what is the idea that drives it, social class and so forth, but furthermore, how racism plays into that particular issue.
The same survey shows nearly two-thirds of black adults, that's about 65%, say they've been in situations where people acted as if they were suspicious of them because of their race or ethnicity. So it's not just the police, it's like a culture.
I would say it's a culture of ignorance, a culture of stupidity. This is nothing to be happy about. This is animalistic. To be suspicious of someone because of the color of their skin, some of the most loving, some of the most successful people I have ever met in the world was Black people. And because of their skin, do you see how ignorant that sounds, brother? To even have a discussion like that. But when you're conditioned from a child to think that Black people are criminals, to think that all Black people are in gangs, to think that all Black people might want to rob you, and you hear the hip-hop music and it's all kill this dude, kill that dude, then you begin to think maybe Black people are dangerous.
Heavy militaristic police presence, frequent stops and searches based on pretext, and disparaging language are all evidence that police view Black and brown people with suspicion and fear. These groups of people are not served by police, rather, they are subjugated by them.
Imagine me walking down the street and someone felt a certain type of way about me. You don't even know I'm a 7-time author. I'm a professional basketball player. But because of our melanin that we have in our skin, because of our woolly hair, some people are intimidated by that. And it's not just a culture of ignorance, it's also fear. A lot of it is fear. Some people naturally fear Black people, and we can't apologize for that. That's between you and God. That's your problem.
Every time there's a high-profile case of a Black person killed by U.S. police, there will be so much talk and protest to address the root causes and so on. So what is it? Nobody knows the root causes, or is it that nobody listens, or perhaps both?
The reason why we are going through these experiences is because society is fundamentally impacted. And then the representatives of society through policing, through social work and care work services, through the education system, the perception of teachers amongst Black children, especially teachers who are in their majority white, middle class, you know, how do they relate to these particular children? And how is that relation? How does that relation rather speak to society in the pupil's latter stages? Okay, so it's an entire societal prognosis that requires a holistic approach, not just policing, not just healthcare, but holistically, even within the very cultures of those that lead us politically.
Since the killings of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor prompted unprecedented uprisings, some racial justice groups have successfully pressured municipal lawmakers to cut police funding and reinvest the money in services. That call has been made every time there's been a high-profile case of police brutality.
If you want to change something, you do it through two ways in this world. Loss of life or loss of profit. Loss of life or loss of profit. Now, we don't advocate violence. That's something we don't do. And that's what people have to understand about Black Americans. We do not advocate violence. Don't let hip-hop music generalize you about Black people. That's ignorant. Don't let what you see in movies generalize you about Black. That's ignorant. You can't never let that happen. But we understand that if you want to change something, if you're not going to do loss of life, then you have to hit the loss of profit. Do we want to defund the police? No. We want to stop getting killed in the streets. We want to stop getting harassed. It's the police who wants to defund the police because they are the root to the problem. Don't ask us if we want to defund the police. The police wants to defund the police because they work for the people and they don't do their job.
Some people argue that police defunding will only lead to more crimes across the nation and something that would hurt the black community even more because they are seen as more vulnerable. Others also argue that this defunding will affect the poorer areas, which are populated more by black people, more than affluent neighborhoods of white people.
Yes, in the sense that I understand the principle of defunding the police, and I understand its foundational ideas around, you know, a much more policed society by, you know, coming from an abolitionist, if you will, mindset, which encouraged, society to be engaged in its own policing and so forth, right? Societal responsibility. I understand that. But do I think defunding them? There are elements within defunding and the defunding campaign, and I don't think that they are actually thinking in the classical sense that I was describing. I was simply giving a historical perspective. But if I'm to look at the things that I do agree with, it's that there has to be societal engagement. And this is one of the tenets that they're pushing for. So less funding towards policing and the militarization of policing, but much more funding going towards the societal aspects that this policing society has to help govern, right? In governing, right? In administering that society.
The conventional wisdom is that Democrats care about the needs of the black community more than Republicans. Do Democrats really care about African Americans, or are they pursuing some sort of political gains here?
Though, when it comes to social programs and much more grassroots-centered policies that would favor, you know, disadvantaged communities in which, black Africans and the black minority, as well as Latinos, Hispanics are in. Okay, so it does make sense where a lot of this mindset comes from. But politics in itself is changing from the notion of identity politics to wokeness to, you know, be it Marxist libertarianism and so forth. And all these different things are going through a process, and this is globally. But in America, we're seeing the same concerns that what is taking much more prevalence through the emergence of Trump is perhaps a tiredness of the collective society in as far as liberalism policies have been working out from a multilateral institution to globalization. How have we fared compared to other countries, right? So they just bring back this greatness, right? But there is no greatness to really look at, considering that we have been discussing the history of slavery and how, you know, as black people in America, as the black Americans have been able to demonstrate a strong global soft power through their popular culture. But this has been fundamentally done through their own efforts, not a large number of policies that have been able to look at that from an institutional perspective that is fundamentally overwhelming to the point that, you know, an entire populations can move away from poverty to the middle class. We're not seeing that. What we're seeing is something totally different. A society that came together and built its own stuff, and it now has a soft.
Political divisions are also apparent when viewing police misconduct toward racial and ethnic minorities. For example, a Pew Research Center poll found that 61% of Republicans compared to 21% of Democrats endorsed the belief that race was getting too much attention following the shooting of Michael Brown, an unarmed 18-year-old young black man who was fatally shot by a police officer in Ferguson, Missouri in 2014.
This soft power that the black community now has to be bargained between the two. I think now the politics that black Americans now have to play is one of collective bargaining. What will you do for me as a consequence of my vote, as the Jewish community would do, as my other Indians, sort of the minority entities have been doing, communities rather have been doing, even here in England, right? To the point in which we now have in the UK, an Indian prime minister. So we have to use our collective bargaining, political soft power, as a tool that will lead to our own economic transformation, which means that the Christians, the Black Christian community, has to collaborate with the Nation of Islam. The Nation of Islam has to collaborate with the Black Jew, the Black Jewish community, right? There needs to be that, you know, a collective approach. Then when we have that collective approach, we can use that, not only from a local policy standpoint, but equally the international. There are multilateral institutions that such an entity, such a collective bargaining instrument or institution would be able to do as a minority group amongst other international platforms as to lobby for their own heritage, which to them will be inherently Africa.
Police are occupying forces in many urban Black and brown communities. People of color too poor to live in a middle class or wealthier neighborhood because of decades of segregation, disinvestment, redlining, and mass incarceration are subjected to heavy and disproportionate surveillance and violence by police. Black people are twice as likely as white people to be shot and killed by a police officer.
We don't know if the world sees us. You know, like, so many people, oh, the United States is this, the United States, but do y'all see how Black Americans are being treated here? You know, we wonder, because we see how y'all, you know, our other countries, they're going through problems. You know, we send donations, we send money, we send help and support, but we wonder if people see us. We are wondering if people understand how badly we deserve reparations. When European Jewish people came out of the Holocaust, they got reparations the next day. You see how they solved their problem? They had their problem solved by reparations. So obviously reparations must be the solution, but nobody wants to talk about it. How do we stop these episodes from repeating themselves? Reparations. That's how it stopped for so-called Jewish people.
Reforming policing will require numerous changes that include improving hiring and training practices and establishing clear standards for what is proper policing, what constitutes misconduct, and appropriate and inappropriate use of force and policing tactics and tools.
I suppose the best way to avoid stoppage of such instances within a short-term context would be, of course, looking at policy. How best can we reform the policing structure? And it could speak to, you know, the immediate need to not perhaps defund, but fund more diverse programs that are also inclusive, so that there's a multi-agency approach to policing that society. You have your social workers, healthcare groups, early childcare intervention programs. You're looking at that whole society and approaching the problem from not one diagnosis, but rather a multitude of concerns that you want to deal with simultaneously. That would be a good short-term program that the Democrats perhaps could push. And I think the language, in order for the Republicans to be agreeable to it, is the policing aspect, the law and order, because you're not taking away funding. You're saying you're going to add more funding. But what you're going to try to do is to diversify how that funding is distributed, right? So it's reframing the language, looking at how best we can quickly intervene into communities from early intervention, so we'll be looking at a scale and indices that are, you know, we're looking at long-term results here. We're not looking at things that will help you win the next election, because I think that's the myopia of policymaking.
Prosecutors know the barometer for what we consider to be criminal conduct for police officers is extremely high, both legally and in the public's perception. Most people perceive that if a police officer did something, he or she was doing it for their protection or the greater good of society. So, the bar for charging and convicting police officers is higher than the bar for regular citizens.
Prosecutors then often take more time to ensure that a case is solid before they bring charges, if ever.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In recent days, depositors of Silicon Valley Bank have closed their deposits, sold the company's shares, and precipitated a financial crisis in the United States. Federal authorities, meanwhile, have shut down another loss-making Signature Bank active in the field of cryptocurrency. We take a look at the world press and media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The website of France 24, France 24, has covered this story and tells us more. President Joe Biden sought to reassure Americans over the country's financial system on Monday, 13th of March, as more U.S. banks and leading European lenders were hammered amid contagion worries. Silicon Valley Bank, a key lender to startups across the United States since the 1980s, collapsed after a sudden run on deposits, prompting regulators to seize control of the institution on Friday, 10th of March. On Sunday night, 12th of March, the U.S. federal authorities stepped in to protect all depositors at Silicon Valley Bank, and regulators took over a second troubled lender. President Joe Biden claimed in a brief White House address, "Americans can have confidence that the banking system is safe. Your deposits will be there when you need them." But there were immediate signs of pressure at additional U.S. lenders. The San Francisco-based First Republic Bank shares collapsed around 62%, while Ohio-headquartered KeyCorp lost 27% and Zion Bank Corporation lost 26%. There was also plenty of red on the screens in Europe, where bourses in Paris, Frankfurt and Milan fell around 3% or more. Germany's Commerzbank closed down nearly 13%. Spain's Santander shed more than 7% of its value. And the Netherlands' ING Bank fell nearly 6%. Credit Suisse, already mired in a scandal, closed down nearly 10% down on its share value. City Index analyst Fiona Cinquotta told Agence France-Presse, "Far from calming nerves, fear of contagion has ramped up further, with investors dumping risky assets across Europe. Banks are leading the charge southwards, with investors taking aim at Spanish and Italian banks, suggesting that these are considered the weakest links in Europe." Most financial market watchers are optimistic that the upheaval will not be comparable to the 2008 financial crisis. Still, many forecasters see a rising risk of recession, especially in light of expectations that the central banks will continue to lift interest rates. The next major move is expected in the coming days, when the European Central Bank, the ECB, meets for a likely half a percentage point interest rate rise. President Joe Biden praised the immediate action taken by officials. In a joint statement on Sunday, 12th of March, the U.S. Federal Reserve, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, and the Treasury Department said Silicon Valley Bank depositors would have access to all of their money starting on Monday, 13th of March. The Fed announced it would make extra funding available to banks to help them meet the needs of depositors, which would include withdrawals. President Biden claimed while the government is ensuring that Silicon Valley Bank depositors get their money back, no losses will be borne by the taxpayers. Biden said the management of the failed banks would lose their jobs and that shareholders would not have their losses covered. But the spectacular speed of Silicon Valley Bank's collapse also added scrutiny on regulators, with analysts noting that the Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell failed to flag a Silicon Valley Bank-type problem last week in 2 days of congressional testimony, suggesting the central bank was caught off guard. The Federal Reserve late on Monday afternoon announced a review of the supervision and regulation of Silicon Valley Bank, an acknowledgement that the crisis had caught the central bank off guard. Wall Street Journal has also covered this story and tells us more. U.S. regulators have closed down New York-based Signature Bank, a big lender in the country's crypto industry, in a desperate attempt to backstop the banking crisis and quell concerns among customers about the safety of their deposits. The closure of the bank marks another major failure in the U.S. banking history, 2 days after authorities shuttered Silicon Valley Bank in a collapse that experts say has shaken the foundations of U.S. economy. In a joint statement released on Sunday, 12th of March, the U.S. Treasury Department, the Federal Reserve and the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation cited the closure of the New York state-chartered commercial bank with total assets of approximately $110.3 billion and total deposits of approximately $88.59 billion as of 31st of December 2022. American regulators said keeping open the 24-year-old institution, which held deposits from law firms and real estate companies, could threaten the U.S. financial system's stability. The U.S. Treasury Department and other bank regulators claimed in the joint statement all of the depositors of Signature Bank and Silicon Valley Bank will be made whole, and no losses will be borne by the taxpayer. According to a reporter on the scene, employees of the bank appeared to gather at the company's Manhattan headquarters on Sunday, 12th of March. However, representatives refused to comment on the news of the bank's closure. President Joe Biden tweeted in reaction to Signature Bank's collapse. Joe Biden tweeted, "I'm fairly committed to holding those responsible for this mess fully accountable and to continue our efforts to strengthen oversight and regulation of larger banks so that we are not in this position again." Joe Biden added, "The American people and American businesses can have confidence that their bank deposits will be there when they need them." Earlier, the U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen said the government wanted to avoid financial contagion from the implosion of the Silicon Valley Bank. In an interview with CBS on Sunday, Janet Yellen said the U.S. government wanted to make sure that the troubles that exist at one bank don't create contagion to others that are sound. She assured that they are working with the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, FDIC, which is the government's deposit guarantee agency, on a resolution to the problem. Janet Yellen claimed, "I'm sure that the FDIC are considering a wide range of available options that include acquisitions. Virginia Democratic Senator Mark Warner said in an interview on ABC News on Sunday that the best outcome would be to find a buyer for Silicon Valley Bank before markets open up in Asia. Media reported that the New York financial institution Signature Bank was forced into closure abruptly on Sunday after losing its risky bet on cryptocurrency, coupled with a run on deposits by investors panicking from Silicon Valley Bank's seizure. The media reported investors had been frightened by the speed at which startup-focused Silicon Valley Bank, the 16th largest lender in the United States, was toppled by customer withdrawals. Silicon Valley Bank's news last week prompted investors to withdraw more than $100 billion in market value from U.S. banks, prompting swift action from government officials over the weekend to try and restore confidence in the U.S. financial system. Financial analysts linked Signature Bank's closure to the panic surrounding Silicon Valley Bank, which regulators had seized on Friday, 10th of March. Meanwhile, the New York Department of Financial Services took possession of the bank pursuant to Section 606 of New York banking law in order to protect depositors.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution during a meeting with the students on Wednesday, November 2nd, 2022. This meeting was held on the occasion of National Students' Day and National Day of Fighting Against Global Arrogance, which are commemorated on the 13th of Aban, 4th of November. In the name of God, the Beneficent, the Merciful, praise be to God, the Lord of the worlds, and peace and blessings be upon our Master, Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, and his pure progeny, particularly the vestige of God remaining on earth. Welcome, my dear ones, our youth, our teenagers. You have made this environment in this Husseinia very pleasant. Your pure hearts, your souls filled with passion. Illuminate the environment and make it pleasant. Wherever you may be, whatever the environment that might be, I have prepared some related topics which I would like to share with you today. My dear children, the first topic is about the 13th of Aban. Well, you have heard a lot about it. The 13th of Aban is a historic day. It is both historic and educational. When we say it is a historic day, it means that on this day, there were events that will remain in history. These events cannot be forgotten, and they should not be forgotten either. They are educational because there have been reactions as a result of these events that serve as a lesson for us. Make use of these experiences for the future of the country, for your future, and for the future of our nation. The future belongs to you.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
This day is an important day for us, but it also really agitates the Americans. This is a day that frustrates the Americans whenever it is commemorated. Your meeting, this meeting, when it is shown, you can be sure that the Americans will be angered by this gathering, this anthem, this communion. They will be agitated by it. Why? Because this day is the embodiment of the evil of the United States and its defeat. So those who think that the US is an untouchable power, when we look at the events that took place on this day, it becomes evident that this is not the case, that is completely vulnerable. This turns into an experience for us. Three events took place on this day, some of which are directly related to the Americans and others are indirectly related to them. One event was the exile of Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh, which took place on the 13th of Aban, November 4th, 1964. Why was Imam Khomeini sent into exile? Because a law was ratified by the direct order of Shah Muhammad Reza Pahlavi to the parliament of that day.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all.
Think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Russian President Vladimir Putin held talks with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in the Kremlin. The head of states of the two countries are in constant contact as relations between Moscow and Damascus are developing in various areas.
Thanks to our joint efforts and the decisive contribution of the Russian armed forces, significant results have been achieved in Syria in the fight against international terrorism. This makes it possible to stabilize the socio-economic and domestic political situation. Unfortunately, the Syrian people faced another very serious problem, a catastrophe, an earthquake. This, of course, exacerbates the situation. As real friends, we are trying to support you. As you know, our units under the Ministry of Emergency Situations also worked here, and representatives of the armed forces stationed in Syria are also contributing to the fight against the consequences of the earthquake.
Meanwhile, Assad expressed support for Russia's special operation in Ukraine and thanked Moscow for its help following the earthquake.
This is my first visit since the beginning of this special operation in Ukraine, and I would like to repeat we fully support your fight against neo-Nazis and old Nazis. I'm talking about the old Nazis, because the West has always received them on the ground and now continues to help them. We support this special operation not because our countries are friends. Our position proceeds from the fact that the world really needs a stabilization now, otherwise